From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the theater of politics, we talk with Frank Rich. His weekly op-ed columns in the New York Times focus on the intersection of culture, media, politics, and government. When he was the Times theater critic, he was dubbed the Butcher of Broadway. Recently, Slate magazine renamed Rich the Butcher of the Beltway. His new book is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Dissident by Nell Freudenberger, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a newly issued historical recording from South African bassist Harry Miller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. New York Times columnist Frank Rich writes frequently on media, culture, and politics. Regular readers of the Times won't be surprised at the title of his new book about the Bush administration. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. Rich argues that President Bush and his team have put politics and the preservation of their own power at the center of national policy decisions. And he says they've proven themselves masters of spin and media manipulation. Rich is also hard on what he calls sleepwalking journalists who failed to question the administration's case for war in Iraq. Frank Rich was the New York Times drama critic for 13 years. Since 1994, he's been a columnist for the newspaper, and he's written three previous books. Well, Frank Rich, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your book deals in part with the Bush administration's skill at managing media images. I thought we would look at one of the more famous of those, and that's the mission accomplished news conference aboard the aircraft carrier, the USS Lincoln, one which I'm sure the administration no doubt regrets. Tell us a little about the planning and execution of that event.
Well, to me, this is sort of a classic, and indeed it's the perfect one to choose as sort of a metaphor for their brilliance at this. As you may recall, it actually was almost a double feature. It began with the president dressed not unlike Tom Cruise in Top Gun, landing a jet on the aircraft carrier in full regalia and being, as if in a World War II movie, being swarmed by, troops congratulating him on this victory, the victory being the war in Iraq, which was essentially going to be ended on this day, not officially ended, but was basically just a mopping up operation was the idea. This was, of course, more than 3.5 years ago, or almost 3.5 years ago. But there was also the second part, which was the speech itself, and that's the one where the banner, Mission Accomplished, was posted above him. That happened later in the day. By then, the president had changed into a business suit, and the set had been redressed. Now there were troops very carefully arranged in color-coordinated dress uniforms that they wouldn't necessarily always wear on this occasion or wear in such neatly colored ranks. The way the president spoke, the way that the aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, was positioned deliberately made it impossible for cameras that were there to see the San Diego skyline, which was in fact only 30 or 40 miles away. But this, by not showing it, you got a sense almost of victory at sea. It heightened the drama. It heightened the selling of the story. What was the story? Mission accomplished, as in the banner, but also the president said that major combat operations had ended in Iraq. The other thing about the speech that's so interesting is that the hour they chose, for instance, he could have given the speech earlier in the day once he had arrived. They could have given it at any time because the whole thing was essentially staged when they were going to use this aircraft carrier. But they deliberately chose that hour late in the afternoon that in Hollywood is known as the magic hour, when everything looks golden and right in the world. You know it from a million Hollywood movies. It's when the couple is having the romantic kiss. It's when the hero is coming home from the war. It's that great moment. All of these were choices. This didn't happen by happenstance. The administration, like others before them, but perhaps they have better versions of them, have people who manage this image, including the set decoration and the staging. They tried, after it turned out that major combat operations had not ended, they tried to sort of kick it away. At one point in a press conference, the president said, people thought everyone on my staff was so ingenious to put Mission Accomplished up there, and they weren't so ingenious. But in fact, of course, it was his people being in charge of it. It was the font used on the banner. It was not some amateur font. It was consistent with fonts used on other backdrops that the administration had used.
That the sailors aboard the USS Lincoln had wanted that banner up, or that was their
right
idea?
In fact, at the time John Stewart made a gag about it, saying, those pesky sign makers in the Navy. They just cannot stop themselves. Their irrepressible banner-making abilities and talents. They ultimately dropped that. For a while, there was someone in the administration was saying, oh, we just meant the mission was accomplished for that one aircraft carrier. And then sometime later, speaking to an editorial board at a newspaper in the Midwest, on the record, Karl Rove said, well, we probably made a mistake with that mission accomplished thing. Now, what was the mistake? The mistake was one of PR. It wasn't a forget about the fact that this war had been mismanaged. The mistake was that they had staged too elaborate a scene that came back to haunt them.
You know, as I've spent a lot of time in the newspaper business covering mostly local issues, but I've covered a number of presidential visits going back to the 80s, visits from Reagan and the first Bush administration and President Clinton and from George W. Bush. And I have to say, they are all stage managed. I mean, the visuals are carefully crafted to convey the message, and the, you know, so-called ordinary citizens are usually screened so that they're on message. That's pretty typical. I mean, is this administration doing anything any differently?
First of all, they're doing it better, and that's sort of the point of my book. Let me walk through a couple of aspects of this. Certainly, what you say is completely true. And I grew up in Washington, not in a political family, during the Kennedy and Johnson years, and some of my most vivid memories are of Kennedy stage managing his presidency in Washington. It was that really in the modern age sort of, you know, was the beginning of this kind of showmanship in the electronic age, in the television age. Eisenhower didn't give a damn about it. But it's gotten more and more sophisticated and to my mind reached sort of an apogee with the Reagan administration, because first of all, you had an actual Hollywood actor at the center of it, and, you know, maybe not the world's greatest, but pretty good. And you had in Michael Deaver a brilliant stage manager who famously would always arrange photo ops that would drown out bad news. But even Deaver, as I quote in my book, is on record as saying, you know, he's just blown away by the Bush administration's sophistication at this. It's much, much more elaborate. Witness mission accomplished. It's also benefits from having many more tools that were not available to previous administrations, because it was really only in the late 1990s that the internet became a mass medium, that CNN had competitors for the first time, and cable news grew exponentially in the number of the number of channels that it eats up and the number of people who watch it. At the same time, also, news divisions at most networks were swallowed up by, as the networks themselves were, by entertainment companies, which increasingly took the already blurred lines of infotainment and blurred them more and more. The Bush administration has been brilliant at capitalizing on this and exploiting it and coordinating it. But there's a second part of it, too.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, suppose you were the producer of a network nightly news program and an image comes across like Bush landing on an aircraft carrier or one of these others. I mean, clearly what the president does on a big moment like this is going to be news. How should they handle these moments differently?
They should at least ask the questions. And that's what didn't happen. They may not be able to get answers, particularly with an administration as secretive as this. But, you know, again, with mission accomplished, if something looks that set up, you can say, well, this is a fine moment for the president. You don't have to be critical. You don't have to be unpatriotic, which in the atmosphere particularly, then you'd be accused of being for saying anything that wasn't with the program. But you can ask questions. You know, are major combat operations really over? What is going on in Iraq? A study that was done during the height of the first few weeks of the war, in the period of, for instance, the falling of the Saddam statue in Baghdad, discovered that there were reporters for the networks who were blocks away from that statue being knocked down who were telling their producers, there's some kind of insurgency or something going on. There's fighting going on in the streets, you know, several blocks away from this cheering and this wonderful tableau. but with rare exceptions, they didn't get on the air. And they certainly, their pictures did not get on the air.
Now, do you think was that because of an ideological commitment to the patriotic message, or was it because they couldn't get pictures of the insurgency?
I don't know. I think it was a combination of the two. I wouldn't use the word ideological. I would use the word patriotic, which is in the sense that it's not that you didn't want to get in the way of the celebration. And the press repeatedly in that period did not want to get away of celebratory events that might have been questioned. You know, the rescue of Jessica Lynch was another. Eventually, news organizations had to take back most of the original accounts of that because there was so much fiction stirred into it. It's skepticism that the press, I feel, failed on. Press doesn't have to be anti the president, anti-American, anti the Iraq war, or anything else. But you have to ask questions. And when you're presented something that is a show, why not ask the questions and let the chips fall where they may? But a lot of that did not happen until much later.
New York Times columnist Frank Rich. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times columnist Frank Rich. His new book about the Bush administration is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold. Well, Frank Rich, apart from managing images, your book argues that this administration has done something kind of more fundamental and deeper, which is to cynically misuse information, even secret intelligence, to mislead the American people. I mean, for example, you cite a number of occasions where warnings of terrorist attacks or terror alerts seemed to be timed to sell a political point or distract the public from an unhelpful story. Maybe give us an example or two of that.
Well, one of my favorite examples that sort of explains the whole picture is during the Ashcroft era, there was a lot of bad news coming out, but some of it particularly about the lack of attentiveness to warnings before 9/11 by the government and by the administration. Those you know, famous signals we now know about during the summer of 01. And this was starting to come out, and particularly Colleen Rowley, a whistleblower from the FBI in the Midwest, was getting ready to testify in Congress, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff like that going on around that time. At one point, John Ashcroft was in Moscow on a routine, you know, attorney general's conference, and he suddenly called a televised press conference announcing that we had arrested Jose Padilla, a former Chicago gang member, in the process of preparing some kind of plot to unleash a dirty bomb in a major, an unspecified, I think, major American city. Well, it's a pretty big deal if the attorney general sort of plays top FBI man and announces this from Moscow in the middle of a trip that had nothing to do with terrorism. We later found out that Padilla had been arrested, in fact, a month earlier. There was absolutely no reason for the announcement to be then. It could have been right after it happened. It could have been 3 weeks later. But there just always seemed to be this announcement of some kind of terrorist threat. And like in the case of Padilla, we still don't even know if this guy had anything to do with the dirty bomb at all. He's never been charged with that kind of thing all these years later. There seemed to be an almost cynical use of this to upstage bad news, and also ultimately in the 2004 campaign to upstage the Democratic convention. And, you know, even now, I mean, Barack Obama said this week, you know, why is it we're always fighting terrorism most in even years in the fall? there's always been something off about it. And plots that we now know, that a lot of plots that were announced and terror threats that were made were based on very, very little. Even, you know, recently this Miami cell to take down the Sears Tower in Chicago and so on. And the price we pay for this is that Americans tune out of a really, you know, we are threatened by terrorists. This is no joke, but it becomes the boy who cried wolf, and it seems so manipulative that people just don't know what's real and what isn't anymore, and I don't think that serves the country.
You know, you're very tough on the mainstream media in your book, perhaps most of all on your own publication, The New York Times, you know, for kind of missing the story on Saddam Hussein's alleged pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. I wonder, have you talked to reporters and editors in your building about this? Why do they think they got it wrong?
We talk about it all the time, and you know, it's a very complicated story, and I have to say it still remains to be told what the full story was. And of course, a lot of people involved, including some of the editors involved, are no longer at the paper. But if you had to look broadly and guess to a certain extent, I don't think it was necessarily ideological. I do think, and interestingly, it didn't just happen at the New York Times, although the New York Times certainly was significantly off. But there with variations on a theme, it happened at other papers as well, but not at every news organization. There were some exceptions. But what seems to have happened is that some top reporters, given access to sources that came from high levels, whether related to the Iraqi National Congress or related to the administration, very credulously reported in the papers the most ominous, as we now know, fake, pseudo, non-existent evidence of WMD activities by Saddam. At the same time, at these same newspapers, for the most part, there were reporters who were getting it right, or at least finding people somewhere in the chain of intelligence saying, this stuff may not be right. This may be overestimated. They may be manipulating the intelligence. And such stories did run, particularly in the Washington Post, to some extent in the Times, even as the other stories dominated and got better play. Indeed, as Dan Okrent, who was the public editor of the Times, who's done the most thorough investigation so far of the Judy Miller stories and our coverage of WMD found, there were some good stories. They were held forever. They were buried in some cases. What was that about? I still don't know the motives of everyone involved. I think a lot of people at the paper are still debating what happened, and it becomes at a certain point, who shot John? Many of the people are gone, but there was, for some reason, a willingness on the part of editors to press down the accelerator of these stories that now, of course, have blown up in our faces and the world's face.
Well, you know, it strikes me that historically, journalists are often a step behind the government when government is selling bad fish. I mean, if you looked at coverage of the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, which Lyndon Johnson used to justify the Vietnam War, I mean, the press then, you know, didn't get to the bottom of what had really happened then. I mean, the My Lai massacre wasn't uncovered by Seymour Hersh until some time later. I mean, is it not the normal thing for people to kind of report the official version, then eventually kind of
get the real version? And of course, journalism, as we all know, is the first draft of history. I think in this case, it's more complicated because, first of all, some people did get the right version. For instance, the Knight Ridder Washington Bureau, that's now McClatchy Newspapers because those papers have since been sold in the past year or so. They, by, as they put it, going to blue-collar sources within the intelligence and military, very consistently, and as these reporters said, they had it all to themselves, found that something was going on and that this stuff was being manipulated. They wrote it in papers that are not in Washington and New York, it's no excuse for no one noticing it. They're major papers, it's a major newspaper chain, but it sort of passed underneath the radar a lot of that mainstream media, even though certainly Knight Ridder is mainstream media itself. And indeed, in writing this book, one of the things that I consistently found is in the run-up to the war in Iraq, there was a lot of evidence hiding in plain sight, often in newspapers, that suggested that there was you could smell a rat here. For instance, 10 days or so before the invasion, Mohammed El-Baradei of the UN Atomic Energy component, saying that these documents that are supposed to show that Saddam was getting uranium from Niger are frauds. They're obvious frauds. Well, it appeared on a couple of front pages of major newspapers, not, I think, in the Times, as I recall. It was inside the Times. It was not picked up, I checked, the day it happened, March 8th, 03, by any of the three network newscasts. And so it's almost, there's a failure there that's pretty obvious. And it may be years before we find out why there was such a failure. But I think that's a little bit different from, say, the Gulf of Tonkin, where it really was hidden. In fact, even now, we're still finding out stuff about what happened during Gulf of Tonkin. Documents are still being released in the past year. But here, a lot of it actually was in public. And that's one of the points I try to make in my book. It just was ignored or disregarded or bad-mouthed.
Frank Rich's new book is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll listen to a newly issued historical recording from the South African bass player Harry Miller. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a debut novel from Nell Freudenberger, and more with Frank Rich on what he calls the decline and fall of truth since 9/11. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Frank Rich. He writes frequently on media, culture, and politics. His new book about the Bush administration is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. There have been a couple of cases where it was revealed that the Bush administration may have actually paid journalists to carry their message or planted fake journalists to advance their cause. What do we know about this activity, and who was responsible for it?
Well, this remains, I think, an unfolding story. It's absolutely fascinating. And see, that's the other half of the equation here. If on one hand you have the administration staging productions and you have a professional news press that is compliant, you also have an administration that's hostile to a professional press, want it to be compliant, and want to destabilize it, attack it, for instance, sometimes attacking, you know, the liberal press, i.e. the New York Times and others, but also creating its own news mechanism that actually infiltrates that media. So we found out that Armstrong Williams, a television pundit, was on the government payroll through various intermediaries and PR firms and so on to plug No Child Left Behind. Ostensibly, that's what the money was for, a Bush administration education program. But in reality, was a pundit about many things that favored the administration over the airwaves while receiving, a grant. There have been many, many documented examples of all sorts of departments and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds, being spent on these video reports that the New York Times and others have found went right into local newscasts, whether they be about how great the prescription drug program is or how well things were going in the war, and just aired by local news stations as if they were network reports. And in some cases, the local news stations were embarrassed when reporters from the Times and others confronted them about this because they didn't even know where they came from. But this is a message.
Is this new in Washington? Have it been other administrations?
New on this scale. Kind of mass video news release in this quantity, this many departments of the government. You want to laugh because at a certain level, it's a farce. And if you see some of these spots, you know, and they have Karen Ryan reporting, they have a reporter named Garcia, so they have, you know, it's like the eyewitness news team. You know, they even have it demographically balanced so that they can hit everybody in a market. It's so cynical and silly at some level, and yet not in terms of the fact that it could so easily permeate the culture and present propaganda as news. You know, where Tommy Thompson, who was the head of Health and Human Resources, is the one expert quoted in one of these news stories that's produced by the government, but the public doesn't know it's produced by the government. It's not presented as a public service commercial. It's presented as, you know, we'll toss to you, Karen, and hear the latest about the, you know, prescription drug benefit.
Well, you know, Frank Rich, you were described in a recent piece in Slate as being perfectly tuned to the voice of Manhattan liberalism. You know, and your column on Sunday, I often look at it and I think, well, here's Frank Rich picking out another piece of lumber to go after the Bush administration. Do you talk to conservatives to get another?
I do. I actually have a number of conservative friends, and I sort of take exception to that characterization of me. I'm certainly, my views are largely liberal, but not doctrinaire. So, and I, you know, it'd be like saying that Slate magazine is the voice of neoconservatism. You know, Washington neoconservatism. You can easily generalize in that way. And by the way, in this crazy world we're in now, there are a lot of places where so-called conservative views and so-called liberal views meet. I mean, I feel, for instance, perhaps more than any Democrat, the most eloquent person in public office about the failings of the war in Iraq and the problems going in. It was Chuck Hagel, who's essentially a conservative Republican, obviously, a senator, who, if you read what he said in the walk-up to the war, although he voted for the resolution, as most of the Senate did, he pinpointed on the floor of the Senate most of what was going to go wrong, way ahead of McCain, let alone Democrats who largely, particularly in the Senate, just wanted to run away from the whole thing. And so I don't consider myself the voice of Manhattan liberalism in that sense.
I guess what I was really getting at was whether you know, when you look at the week's events and pick out, you know, the information you want to present and give it the analysis that you give it. I mean, do you run that past somebody who has a different perspective and say, you know, let's vet this. Let's make sure that I'm not in an echo chamber here reading people I agree with.
Yeah, I do sometimes, and I talk about it constantly with people, friends of mine, liberal and conservative, and I have to say, what really interests me about it anyway is not so much the ideology but the story. I'm very interested in the narrative of what happens in a given week, or in the case of this book, in the past few years. And I'm trying to figure out what the story is, because I think the story is the key to what's going on. And in this time of massive production facilities, and by the way, the Democrats try to do much of the same production values that Republicans do. It's just incredible that they're so incompetent at it, particularly given all their connection, you know, their much vaunted connections to Hollywood. But I'm trying to figure out the through line, and I do debate that a lot with people I talk to, as well as debating with myself and changing my mind about things. I'm never going to believe that the Iraq War was a good idea, but what I'm trying to do anyway is, that's obvious. That opinion's obvious. And if you support the war, that opinion is obvious too. I'm trying to get at the underpinnings of the mechanics that make it work and make it continue to go astray, if in fact it is going astray, and the motives of people involved, and what it tells us about not just politics, but our culture and our values to some extent.
Well, you know, at the end of your book, I mean, you pose the question, if the Bush administration couldn't have really believed that Saddam Hussein was building nuclear weapons and pursuing weapons of mass destruction, as you believe, why did Bush take the nation to war with Iraq? Explain your answer to that question.
First of all, we don't know, and history is going to have to tell us, which, as I say, indeed, Richard Haass, who worked in the State Department and is now the head of Council on Foreign Relations, I think has described it as the Rashomon of wars. What I feel in the end was there were a number of things going on. There was, of course, the neocon clique and the Cheney clique that had its ideological reasons for going to war in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, but with their vision of the Middle East and their other views about making good on what wasn't finished in the 1991 Gulf War. You had other concerns about oil, about protecting Israel, perhaps, foreign policy issues. You did not have nation building. Nation building, the administration was against. Rumsfeld gave a speech against nation building a month before the invasion. That's something that's been grafted on now. That was never a reason. So you had all these reasons, and yet you also had, in my view, an administration that puts politics over everything. And when this was going on, it was 2002 is when they started selling the war. Several things had happened. We had won the war in Afghanistan, or so we thought at the time. We had successfully, in my view, it was very important, taken out this regime that sheltered Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorists. But what hadn't happened was we had not found Osama bin Laden, who'd been lost in Tora Bora sometime in December of 01, possibly, seemingly through incompetence and bad decisions. That, however, was not quite yet known to the public. We also had the beginning of waning polls for the president, coming down off those huge highs, and polls showing that that the war on terrorism was beginning, people were beginning to have some doubts about it, about how long it should be fought, and so on. And we had a midterm election coming up. And if you look at this incredible rush to war, it now seems ridiculous given what we know now. It all started happening in the summer of 2002. That's when the White House formed something called the Whig Group, the White House Iraq Group, largely PR oriented, with people like Karen Hughes and Andy Card and Mary Madeline in it to sell a war, even as we pretended publicly that no decision had been made. Well, the decision had been made, and I feel that the political aspect of it played a role as Bush's ratings started to fall, and that Karl Rove was on record at the beginning of that year saying that, as he still is, that war is the best political prescription he had for this presidency, which really didn't have much on its mind before 9/11, except tax cuts, which had already been accomplished. And so I think there was a lot of festering to go after Iraq anyway. We know that from a lot of inside accounts, starting with Richard Clark's. But I think the catalyst that finally pushed it forward, if there was any doubt, was it was an election year and this rattling up of, as Andrew Card put it, rolling out a new product. And I wonder now if we're seeing a little bit of history repeat itself as we're in another midterm election year and we're talking about Iran with kind of deja vu all over again about some of it.
Well, you know, it seems as I read that final chapter, I mean, it seems to me you come down pretty hard on the conclusion that this war was really an election strategy, in effect by Karl Rove, that we needed a war to kind of do a simple, quick, easy way to make sure that this administration had the high ground in the war on terror.
Absolutely, and it was predicated on the false premise that it would be a fast slam dunk war. It wasn't predicated on that there were WMDs. We now know that there was too much intelligence telling the administration otherwise, that there was no smoking gun for a mushroom cloud. But there was a sense that we would, and all the war planning obviously reinforces this, we would just go in and knock out this jerk, criminal, Saddam, and mission accomplished, and go home, and it was sort of regarded as a cost-free thing. And when people say now, isn't it great Saddam is no longer a power? Well, of course it's great that he's no longer in power, but would that it were that simple. And the real issue in my mind is we probably could have contained him, and while he's horrible, the results of this adventure seem to be far worse.
But I guess what struck me about this, it just seems like such a deeply cynical interpretation of events that all of this was to win congressional elections. I mean, it just seems like a really extreme point of view.
I don't think of it as extreme. I guess it is somewhat cynical, and the cynicism has been, you know, fostered by the way they have just misrepresented things to the American people from the get-go, probably lied or certainly believed their own lies and foisted them upon us. And I wish that they had just told us the truth. If they had a better record of telling the truth, I guess I would be less cynical.
Well, Frank Rich, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
New York Times columnist Frank Rich. His new book about the Bush administration is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead on a newly issued historical recording by South African bassist Harry Miller. This is Fresh Air. Our critic Kevin Whitehead says everybody knows jazz is an American invention that mediates between African and European musical conventions. But for decades, African and European improvisers have been forging their own bonds and hybrids without American mediation. As a case in point, Kevin reviews a newly issued historical recording by the South African bassist Harry Miller.
Bassist Harry Miller's sextet, Isipingo, 1975. Miller's band was half English and half South African, a perfect emblem of bicontinental cooperation. In fact, Miller sort of initiated such contacts in 1961 when he, along with friend and future hitmaker Manfred Mann, emigrated from Cape Town to the UK. In 1965, Miller got some company when the interracial Cape Town combo The Blue Notes turned up in London. From then on, the South Africans' catchy, easy chord tunes, layered riffs, and rolling rhythms were an invitation to English players to join in. Jazz was their common language, and improvisation the glue. Now, African and European musicians were influencing each other long before the transatlantic slave trade, and it's not like sub-Saharan choirs or church-going Europeans needed Americans to teach them call and response. That said, Nick Evans' shouting trombone owes a lot to Texas field hollers. Even Euro improvisers exploring their own roots had African-American role models. Harry Miller's CD, Which Way Now, on the Cuneiform label, was recorded live in 75. The sound isn't glorious, but it more than doubles Isipingo's recorded output. The sextet sounds like a pint-sized cousin to the South African-English big band, Brotherhood of Breath. Like a steamship, it's powerful but not geared for sudden turns. There's a joyful exuberance and carefree slapdash quality that are hard to separate. Those twin tendencies are personified by trumpeter Mangezi Feza, like Isipingo drummer Louis Maholo, a member of the Blue Notes. Feza has his technical shortcomings, but sometimes he gets the most beautiful ragged sound this side of Don Cherry. That's bandleader and King Crimson sideman Keith Tippett on piano. Isipingo's other Englishman is alto saxophonist Mike Osborne, who had a trio with bassist Miller and drummer Maholo and really dug into their rhythmic concept. His well-turned solo on the tune Which Way Now wittily combines woodwind practice drills and Ornette Coleman's slippery blues tonality. Isipingo issued only one LP in the 70s, which makes this belated sequel especially welcome, even if they're not always in tune and do let things run on. The band only lasted a couple more years. Harry Miller moved to Holland in 1977, helping to incite a vogue for South African-style tunes over there. He died following a post-gig road accident in 1983. The last surviving member of the Blue Notes, drummer Louis Maholo, now known as Louis Maholo Maholo, recently retired to his homeland, bringing this era of international cooperation to an informal end.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Which Way Now, the historical recording by Harry Miller's sextet Isipingo. It's on the Cuneiform label.
¶¶
Coming up, a review of the debut novel by Nell Freudenberger, best known for her award-winning short story collection, Lucky Girls. This is Fresh Air. Nell Freudenberger lived every young writer's dream when her first short story was published in the New Yorker magazine. She was 26 at the time and an editorial assistant at the magazine, writing fiction in the morning before work. Her award-winning short story collection, Lucky Girls, was published in 2003 and made our book critic Maureen Corrigan's Best Books list that year. Freudenberger has just published her first novel, The Dissident. Maureen has a review.
The plot of Nell Freudenberger's debut novel, The Dissident, has all the makings of a classic screwball comedy. Allowing for racial differences, you could even see Cary Grant in the title role. A Chinese artist named Yuan Zhao, who spent time in prison for staging politically incendiary performance pieces, is invited to be a visiting scholar at a posh girls' academy in Los Angeles. Mr. Yuan, as the dissident is called, is put up for the year in a pool house on the estate of the Travers family, whose troubled teenage daughter attends the school. In exchange, Mr. Yuan is supposed to teach a class there and create new artworks. Except as the months go by, our artist in residence doesn't seem to be producing much except copies of other people's paintings. Maybe there are just too many emotional distractions in the wacky Travers mansion. Gordon, the father, is an obtuse psychiatrist whose only passion is genealogical research. The fluttery mom, Cece, has been carrying on a long affair with Phil, her charming, shiftless brother-in-law. And the adolescent son of the house, Max, has been arrested for weapons possession and is doing community service in the barrio. Or perhaps the problem lies with the evasive Mr. Yuan himself, who confides in us readers at the outset of the story that he's really expert at only one thing, counterfeiting, a crime that's, after all, a snap to pull off amidst a crowd of self-involved Westerners who merely glance at their Asian guest and take him at face value. The madcap possibilities in this setup are obvious, but The Dissident isn't funny enough to be a comedy, nor is it profound enough to be a commentary on cross-cultural blindness, nor, I'm sorry to say, is it as compelling as Freudenberger's amazing short story collection, Lucky Girls, which deservedly made her the literary wunderkind of 2003. Freudenberger tackles the same themes in this novel as she did in Lucky Girls, namely people from disparate cultures trying and failing to only connect. And to give The Dissident its due, the sudden cruel plot twists and offbeat but precise way with words that distinguished Lucky Girls are also present intermittently throughout this novel. I can and will quote some fine writing, like in this shrewd observation from Yuan Zhao at the beginning of the novel about the aura of cultural superiority exuded by his American hosts. The Travers were not at all surprised by my excellent English. If anything, they were disappointed by the force of my accent, which they assured me I was losing almost from the day I arrived. To them, English wasn't really a language. It was a genetic gift, present in everyone, but unfortunately latent in some people, like biceps. It only had to be strengthened and drawn out. But proportional to its 400-plus page length, there just aren't enough of these shimmering moments to really lift The Dissident into the exalted literary league of its predecessor. And the characters, particularly the Travers clan, but even the enigmatic Yuan Zhao himself, are pretty much Johnny One-Notes, who aren't interesting enough to sustain this long tale. Enough. It's a commonplace piece of wisdom among writing teachers that the hardest student papers to improve upon are not the C-range disasters, but rather those pesky B-plus essays that are good, just not good enough. That's what The Dissident feels like to me. Good, but especially in light of Lucky Girls, just not good enough.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Dissident by Nell Freudenberger. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Puccini's Ghost, a novel of psychological suspense by Morag Yass, author of Half-Broken Things. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology. Capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the double life of Jim McGreevy. He talks about coming out of the closet and resigning from his job as governor of New Jersey. Also, we'll hear from two reporters who've covered McGreevy's story for the Star-Ledger. Join us for the next Fresh Air.